It was August 28, 1984. Elizabeth Fritzl had just turned 18. What should have been a happy time in her life was soon to become a living nightmare. At some point that day, Elizabeth would disappear and not be seen again for 24 years. Soon after her disappearance, Rosemary Fritzl, Elizabeth's mother, filed a missing persons report. No trace of her daughter could be found. Then, almost a month later, her father, Joseph Fritzl, produced a letter postmarked from Braunau, a city 100 miles from their home in Austria. According to the letter, Elizabeth was staying with a friend. She demanded her family not search for her, or she would leave the country. Joseph told the authorities she had probably joined a religious cult. They must have taken him at his word, and nothing else was done to find her after that day. Another 24 years would pass until the world would hear from Elizabeth again. She was never missing. At least, Joseph knew where she was the entire time. As it turned out, that same day that she had turned 18, he had trapped her in a hidden chamber that he had specifically built for her, in the basement. From then on, he would visit her at least 3 times a week, bring her food and other supplies. What followed involved graphic detail. Because of Joseph's repeated indecent assaults, 7 children would be born to Elizabeth in her prison, although 1 died soon after birth. 3 of the children, Lisa, Monica, and Alexander, were removed as infants and raised by Joseph and Rosemary. This was all approved by local social services after Joseph claimed the babies had just been left on his doorstep. Upon the birth of the 4th child, Joseph was kind enough to allow the chamber to be enlarged. Elizabeth and the children were made to dig out every inch of soil by hand. The undertaking lasted several years. As terrible as all this must have been, it could have been far worse. The captives were allowed to have things like a refrigerator, television, and VCR. During their ordeal, Elizabeth taught the 3 remaining children, Kirsten, Stefan, and Felix, how to read and write. Occasionally, Joseph would shut off the power and forget to deliver them food in order to teach them a lesson. In a couple of different instances, he went as far as telling them that they would be gassed or electrified to death if they attempted to escape. Then, on April 19, 2008, the eldest daughter, Kirsten, fell unconscious. Elizabeth managed to convince Joseph to seek medical attention for her. She assisted Joseph in carrying their child out to an awaiting ambulance. It would be the first time she had been outside in 24 years. Although she was forced to return and stay another week, her nightmare was soon to end. Once again, Joseph arrived with a letter supposedly written by Elizabeth. Fortunately, staff at the hospital found many aspects of his story puzzling and called the authorities. That was when the investigation into Elizabeth's disappearance was reopened. Joseph was questioned, and an expert on cults found his story improbable. Because her illness was so severe, Elizabeth pleaded to be allowed to visit Kirsten in the hospital. Amazingly, Joseph agreed, and Elizabeth, along with her 2 sons, were allowed to leave the basement for the final time. During the visit, a doctor tipped off authorities and both adults were taken into custody. Once she was assured that she was finally safe, Elizabeth shocked police with a story of her decades-long imprisonment and abuse. Shortly after midnight, Joseph, now 73, was formally arrested. The next day, Elizabeth, the children, and Rosemary were taken into protective custody. It's believed Rosemary never had any idea of what was happening to her daughter. Over the next few days, DNA would prove Joseph to be the father of Elizabeth's children, although his lawyer would insist this did not prove false imprisonment. Police believe Joseph was planning on contriving a story of how he rescued his daughter from the supposed cult to cover for the unexplained appearance of Elizabeth. The trial of Joseph Fritzl commenced on March 29, 2009. He stood trial for the death of the newborn, kidnapping, false imprisonment, and several other despicable actions. Pursuant to an agreement made to her by police, Elizabeth would be allowed to give videotaped testimony before prosecutors. Joseph pled guilty on all charges except murder and threatening to gas Elizabeth and the children. The jurors spent 11 hours that first day watching footage of Elizabeth's testimony. The tape was said to be so upsetting that 8 of the jurors could only watch 2 hours of the testimony at a time. 4 alternates were put on standby in case any juror asked to be excused. Elizabeth's older brother, Harold, also testified to being abused by Joseph as a child. The second day, Elizabeth herself appeared at the trial. Joseph was visibly shaken by her arrival, going pale and breaking down. The next day, he would change his plea to guilty on all charges. He's currently serving out a life sentence at Garston Abbey Prison in Upper Austria. He is eligible for parole after 15 years. On a good note, Kirsten was reunited with her family after being put under an artificially induced coma. She has since made a complete recovery. For the sake of the privacy, I won't say where Elizabeth and the children are living today. I will include that they are doing their best to live normal lives and heal from such a traumatic experience. The house that bore witness to these crimes was put up for sale and purchased in December of 2016. The purchasers planned to convert the property into apartments. The basement itself was filled with concrete in June 2013 at a cost of 100,000 euros. Although in an interview in 2017, Joseph still showed no remorse for his actions, and in April 2019, it was reported that his health was in decline and he didn't want to live anymore. But we can only pray that he gets what he asked for, after creating a generational nightmare in a subterranean prison. When we were kids, we don't always listen to the adults around us. Part of growing up requires us to push boundaries, or we never know when we've gone too far. It's just a fact of life. Adults know this and try their best to let us learn on our own. Even then, they won't hesitate to put their foot down in the best interest of our safety. I know this now and did the same to my kids when they were young. However, there was a time you couldn't tell me anything. I constantly pushed the boundaries and never learned from my mistakes. That is, until I almost died. In my youth, I was a handful. Too much for my mother, in fact. My dad had been shot down and killed in Vietnam. I had only been 2 at the time. My mother didn't date, and both my grandfathers had passed. I lacked any male role models in my life, and Mom tried, but just couldn't fill this role. This was another time, and Mom was a small-town simple lady. I was old enough to know that she was overworked and not the assertive type. I naturally exploited this. I had not yet fallen into crime, but she feared I soon would. She searched out a solution and soon came up with a perfect one. Spring break would soon arrive. She would need someone to look after me during the day. This is when Dad's mother, Granny Jean, came into the picture. Mom and Granny Jean never saw eye to eye, but they kept things civil. As I'd soon discover, Granny Jean was just what I'd needed. She'd grown up in the Depression. It made her tough, a no-nonsense type of woman. She had no time for foolishness, but was still capable of showing love when appropriate. The two spoke on the phone, and she agreed to take me for the week. I left for the farm on that Sunday morning and arrived by bus later that day. A daunting trip for a lone 9-year-old. Not that I would have admitted it. Granny Jean picked me up at the station and we drove the 25 miles back to the farm in silence. I say silence, but there was a preacher talking on the radio for most of the ride. I began to speak once until I got the stink eye from Granny and figured I'd be better off shutting up. Not until breakfast the following morning did she truly talk to me. Afterwards, I received a quick lesson on feeding the animals and then was left to entertain myself. So, naturally, I took off in search of trouble. Most of the day was spent walking the fields and exploring the woods. I returned briefly for lunch, then renewed my explorations. Around 4, I came across this old abandoned farmhouse. It was a massive thing, 2 stories and a big wraparound porch. I couldn't resist. I quickly looked through the windows to make sure no one was inside. Seeing nobody, I walked around back and entered. There wasn't much to see, but to me it was like a giant clubhouse. It was getting late, so I left, with all intention of returning. That evening at dinner, I happened to make mention of the old house. No sooner had I said it, Granny Jean jumped down my throat. "That's not your property. Don't you go back there. It's old and dangerous. It's not safe. Do you understand?" I was terrified by her reaction, and sheepishly I said, "Yes, ma'am." I was shocked by my own words. I'd not been in the habit of respecting my elders, but she was in full control, and she knew it. Well, almost full control. That night, as I lay in bed, all I could think about was the old house. There was still so much to explore. I had to go back. And I did the next morning, borrowing a flashlight on my way out. Beginning where I'd left off the day prior, I climbed the creaky stairs to the second floor. Had I been smarter about the layout of the old houses, I would have tried to explore the attic, but I didn't realize it was there. I did encounter a door that likely led to it, but it being locked, I moved on. I had much more to see. Having found nothing of note at this point, I returned to the kitchen. A door I hadn't yet tried was located there. It was difficult to open, but after a few hard yanks, it broke free. Ahead of me were stairs leading into a basement. The darkness before me screamed, "Come down." With my borrowed flashlight in hand, I descended down those stairs. One step had long since rotten away, and I jumped it. It's a miracle the step I landed on didn't snap too. Reaching the bottom, I swept the large room with a beam of light. I couldn't see much from my position. Therefore, I made the mistake of taking a closer look. I took two, maybe three steps, and the door above me slammed shut. To this day, I'm not sure what caused it to close. A gust of wind is the most likely guess, but I'm almost positive I closed the back door behind me. I could be wrong. I was never good about closing doors, so no matter how improbable, it is actually possible. I'll not entertain any other of the more outlandish theories. I jolted back up the stairs, skipping two or three at a time. I threw myself against the door, but it wouldn't budge. Again and again I did this, but to no avail. And I was trapped. I began panicking. Then, suddenly, I remembered the big swinging doors I'd seen when I arrived. I frantically raced back down, jumping steps in pairs. The second to last broke under my weight, sending me tumbling across the floor. The room was now very dark. I realized my flashlight wasn't working. I shook it rapidly and it came to life. I returned to my feet and renewed my sprint to freedom. The doors were two heavy wooden things that opened out. I'd need a lot of power to budge them. I summoned up all my strength and threw my body against them, but nothing. I repeated this twice more until I was too tired to continue. I took a break and tried to think. I closed my eyes and concentrated intensely. I pictured the doors as I'd seen them the day before. My mind's eye scanned every inch, every nail, every board. All hope I had disappeared in an instant. I should have remembered the large board straddling the doors from the outside. It was a sturdy-looking 2x4 or something of similar size. It spanned the entire breadth of the opening, slid tightly under four metal braces. I'd not lost complete hope just yet. I wandered back and forth around the room, examining every square inch. There were a couple of small windows. Perhaps if I broke them, I could squeeze out. A nearby brick was put into use, but it just bounced off the panes. I know now that it was reinforced, stormproof glass. No matter the amount of foolish optimism or stubbornness I embodied, as the hours passed, my courage began to fail me. Things wouldn't truly begin to suck until night came on. Although the days had been somewhat warm, the nights still dipped below freezing. As the sun set, my prison became colder and colder. Then, just after 11 p.m., the flashlight gave out, and shaking it no longer worked. With no moonlight, it was completely pitch black. Rats began scattering about all around me, and I was now at the lowest point in my young life. My surroundings terrified me more than the thought of freezing to death. Visions of rats gnawing on my limbs, being too weak to move, overwhelmed me. Sleep became harder and harder to avoid. Even then, I knew if I fell asleep, I might not wake up again. I had no doubt that help would be coming, but would they reach me before I froze, or worse, was eaten alive? Sometime in the early hours of the night, I lost the battle and slipped into unconsciousness. In that sleep world, I could feel my soul being carried upward. I was no longer shivering. My body was warm, and I no longer hurt. This had to be heaven, I thought to myself. But fortunately, it was not my time. But rather than heaven, I was back in bed. The smell of baked things floated up from the kitchen and was all very disorienting. Had I just dreamed this, I thought? I looked around, and nothing was out of the ordinary. The sun was shining through the white lace curtains. Rags, Granny Jean's tabby cat, was curled up in the chair watching me. I was wearing my favorite flannel pajamas, and all seemed well. Yet just below the surface, something gnawed at me. I slipped quietly into my robe, not wanting to ruin the peace of the morning. Rags followed close behind, and I stepped softly down the stairs. The rotten stairs of the basement flashed in my mind. Maybe I was in hell. A proper punishment for such an unruly child like myself. This would be a particularly bitter pill. I expected to be swarmed by a horde of rats any moment. Maybe Rags was their leader. He ran ahead of me and turned the corner, and I braced for the gruesome onslaught, but it never came. I reached the bottom. Looking left, I could see Granny Jean, her back to me, the same gray hair wrapped into a tight bun. She sat at the kitchen table. The calm swaying of an old string instrumental flowed lazily from her little radio. I just stood and watched for a long time, a slight tug of tension lurking just below the surface. A few minutes passed, and Granny Jean turned in her chair, kindly wishing me a good morning. I joined her in the kitchen, still unsure of what to say. "Are you hungry?" The words were comforting yet unsatisfying. "Yes," I answered with a quick jerk. I stood still and watched as she gathered the food. She was consumed with her work, yet perhaps even then aware of the turmoil raging inside of me. She cracked two eggs into a skillet. The sizzle and captivating scent of bacon rose in the air. "I don't think we need to discuss what happened last night. You're safe now, and I'm sure a boy even as stubborn as you has learned his lesson." The relief was indescribable. I fought back the tears, but a few escaped. Their warmth, all the more soothing, I didn't want her to see, and I turned my back to her and spoke. "No, ma'am. I see now just how difficult I've been, and I'm sorry." And that was it. Granny Jean plated up my breakfast, and we sat together as I ate, not speaking, the soothing, swaying strings blending into the warm, fragrant air of the kitchen. For the remainder of my visit, I stayed pretty close to the farm. There were plenty of reruns on TV and chores to keep me occupied. I had meant every word I'd said that morning. A veil had been lifted. All the trouble I'd caused, my willful headstrongness, it led me to that cold basement. The adults around me only had the best in mind for me. Yet all I ever heard was no. The old version of myself did die that night. When the week came to an end, Granny Jean drove me back to the bus station. As we parted, she gave me a little peck on my cheek. I'd never felt so grateful in my life, and I still hold a very special place in my heart for her. On my way to the bus, I turned back and waved goodbye to her. Had I known it would be the last time I'd see her, I would have thanked her for it all. She'd not just saved my body that dark, cold night. She'd done one better. She'd saved my soul. Everyone around him knew him as Big Joe, but his parents called him Joseph. The Gibsons were friendly and cool for older folks. A lot of parents would have been overprotective of a child with Big Joe's disability, but he was allowed to live just like every other kid. I know now that Big Joe had a condition called Down syndrome. As kids, we knew he was different, but we didn't care. If he was picked on, we were usually there to stand up for him. Those kids never spoke a word crosswise about him in our presence again. He was everyone's best friend and never expected anything in return. That's why his disappearance affected us all so much. I don't remember the exact date, but I do know that I was nearing 13. Several of us had met up to play baseball. We knew Big Joe loved playing, and he would be sad if we didn't include him. We went to the Gibsons' house, and when Mr. G told us Joseph had went away, we asked when he'd be back. I'm sorry, boys. Joseph won't be coming back. He wouldn't say any more, so, with a heavy heart, we walked back to the field and tried getting by without our favorite pitcher. Big Joe may have gone away, but he wasn't forgotten. My friends and I would do our darndest to discover the truth, but it seemed nobody had a clue, not even the adults. There were loads of theories, though. The most popular was that Big Joe had become too much to handle for his older parents. We assumed that he'd been sent off somewhere for his own good. It was an unsatisfactory conclusion, but there wasn't much we could do about it. Life went on and time passed quickly. I worked my way through community college and would eventually become a child psychologist. A few of my childhood friends would reach out now and then. The discussion would always get around to Big Joe. The institutional theory was taken as fact by then, and we hoped he was happy and well-treated wherever he was. My practice was just beginning to support itself, and I decided to take a short vacation with my family to visit my folks. Our first night was without note. It was the next morning when everything changed. The whole family was sat around the table for breakfast. My dad was talking about a new housing development being built, and that was when he dropped the bomb. "Oh yeah, did you hear about the old Gibson house?" I figured he was talking about being leveled for the new development, and I was only half right. They did demolish it, but during the process they found a body buried in the basement. He said it like it was an everyday occurrence. I began to choke. Something like this demanded an explanation. "I'm sorry, son. I assumed you already knew. They were in the process of digging for leftover pipes or wires and exposed a skeleton." All kinds of questions were rushing through my head. All except the most obvious one. Both Gibsons passed long ago. No one had lived in the house for at least 10 years. I asked if they identified the body, and it was obvious that he was about to make a guess. "Come on, boy. You know who it is. You're avoiding the most probable option in favor of the most improbable." This is one of his favorite sayings. He'd throw it at me whenever he thought I was being dense. I fought for a moment, but nothing came to me. He could see the strain on my face. And I remember all of these words like they were yesterday. "Okay, stop. Take a few breaths, close your eyes, and it will pop out in front of you." My old man knew me well. I did as he suggested and calmed my mind. Then bang, it hit me like a truck. And my old man had always been able to read me like a book. "Big Joe?" My excitement quickly switched to confusion and concern. Once again, he could read my thoughts. "No, son. It's not what you think. The doctors are almost certain the man died of natural causes." I do want to mention here that although we saw Big Joe as a kid like us, it turned out he was actually nearing 25 when he passed. Although relieved, I was unable to overcome my confusion and disgust. Why hadn't they just buried him the regular way? It's not fair that we didn't get to say goodbye one last time. I wanted answers, but asking Dad would have been pointless. Now that I knew, I had to visit his gravesite as soon as possible. And after a small amount of research, I did find it. And this was something I was going to have to do alone. I just remember as I stood beside the grave, I began telling him everything he missed since he went away. I told him about my wife and kids, how the Sox finally won the pennant. And then I realized he hadn't missed a thing. He had been with me all these years. I'd been carrying him in my heart the whole time. For the last few days, I've been reading about various Reddit members' run-ins with creepers, stalkers, and other downright freaky people. Now that I've gotten good and inspired, I figured I'd add my story to the list. This starts about 5 years ago. My family, consisting of myself, my brother Alec, and of course my mom, were moving around a lot. At this time, my mom was having a hard time finding a full-time job that paid well. On several occasions, we'd been forced to move out in the middle of the night. This would all change when she got on at a well-known lock manufacturer just a city over. The company even provided her with the money to rent a house near the factory, and things were starting to look up for sure. The move proved to be unremarkable, as was her first few weeks in the new place. Despite being nothing special, it was almost paradise to us kids. The neighborhood was a regular working-class area loaded with other kids and plenty of things to keep us busy. Ever since our dad passed when I was about 10, life had been pretty touch and go. But now it was almost like things used to be, at least for a while. During this time, we all did our usual stuff. Mom worked as much as possible, and Alec and I attended school. Then, we started hearing noises. I was the last to notice them. I think Alec mentioned them once, but I wrote them off as nothing. Mom hadn't bothered to say anything for a few days, but one morning at breakfast, we all heard it together. This one resembled a ring chime on a phone. It only happened twice that morning, one after another. We all three began comparing notes and were relieved to know we weren't the only persons hearing things. We agreed it was probably a bird outside. This was not the only sound we'd been noticing, but for the day, we put them out of our minds and began discussing more important goings-on. Nothing else of note would occur this day, but the idea had been brought up. We'd all be far more tuned in and probably wouldn't hesitate to mention anything new in the future. For the next few weeks, one of us would hear a bump on the floor or a scratching sound. We'd make a mental note of it and go on with what we were doing. On weekend mornings when we were all together, we'd mention the week's experiences. We even searched the house once and discovered a small hole leading into the attic. We figured a little critter was going in and out and making some of the sounds. There were still a few sounds that would have been impossible for a rat or squirrel to make. We thought we may have our answer, but some lingering doubts remained. The real trouble started when the food began disappearing. This part of the story affected me specifically. For as long as I can remember, I've had a problem with my weight. I've learned to control it in the years since, but my childhood was made very difficult because of it. This was made worse by my mom. She'd always been thin and beautiful and couldn't understand why I wasn't. When food began disappearing from the kitchen, she blamed it on me. This incident, in addition to a few others, damaged my relationship with my mom so badly, her and I still don't speak that often. But you aren't here to listen to my problems. You want to hear something scary, and that part comes next. I'd estimate we'd been living at the new house for around 5 months. Mom and I were barely speaking, and the noises were still an ongoing problem. We'd since decided the house was haunted. Almost a month after covering the hole in the attic and another leading into the basement, the sounds continued. What had once been a strange problem had become frustrating. We'd all had our own issues. Alec himself had been having breathing problems akin to chronic bronchitis. He just started his freshman year of high school and was playing in the school band. He had been up and down with his symptoms. On this particular week, he had been doing well enough to go on a trip out of town. Unfortunately, soon after arriving, his symptoms blew back up and he was sent home for treatment. He arrived back home in the middle of the day when my mom and I weren't around. Things were quiet at first, but soon he heard noises coming from the front bathroom. He called out, but no one answered. Not thinking anything was wrong, he went to the door and opened it. To his horror, a man he didn't know was standing half-dressed, staring at him. He said the man moved toward him. Believing he was going to be attacked, he fled from the house and ran to a neighbor's residence for help. This was where he stayed until the cops completed their search. What they discovered would destroy our newfound sense of peace and cause long-term damage. When I arrived home, Mom was still speaking with the police. My confusion quickly gave way to terror after hearing their story. As they cleared the home, nothing appeared out of the ordinary. That was until they searched the basement. There they discovered a makeshift bedroll under the stairs, hidden behind a large stack of boxes. Although the intruder was gone from what they found, it looked as if though he had been sleeping there for some time. I felt like I had been kicked in the stomach, and I became slightly hysterical for a moment. Once I'd gotten myself composed, I asked about Alec. He was still across the street and refused to return home. His hands were shaking and sweat was pouring down his face. A few hours passed and the authorities had all they needed for the time being. We all returned to the house in a vain attempt to move on. The side effects began to show themselves almost immediately. Alec was eventually convinced to return, but he was never the same. Nightmares became a nightly occurrence. He was unable to sleep until Mom or I showed him the basement was empty. Worst of all, his breathing trouble grew worse by the day, and I too was greatly affected. Every minute inside the house made my skin crawl. As for Mom, she said nothing, but the strain showed on her face. Her sleep too had obviously been hindered. With no news of an arrest, we were all drowning in fear. We did all we could think of to comfort each other, but it didn't do any good. At the end of the 7th month, we moved into a new place. This was a 3-bedroom condo without an attic or basement, and I remained there for another 2 years before getting my own place across town. I've been here ever since. After moving from the house, it seems all of our lives have improved. I'm fit, happy, and in a loving relationship. My mom found love with a gentleman from work and they married a year ago. Even poor Alec is doing well. His breathing problems slowly disappeared after the move. Doctors would discover his problems were likely related to the massive amounts of black mold we had been inhaling. After the diagnosis was made, the health department contacted the landlord only to discover the house had been demolished soon after we left. I see this as an admission of guilt. Alec's night terrors gradually lessened with the passage of time, and from what he tells us, he rarely thinks about the incident anymore. I'm not sure he's being totally truthful, but I'm happy to hear it nonetheless. The intruder is still on the loose, as far as I know. He's not even been identified. We'll probably never know the full story. He could have gotten in through an unlocked door or a window. At that point, he could have had a key made for the back door. Our big ring of keys that hung on a hook next to the kitchen wouldn't be hard to find. And from then on, he'd have free rein over the house during the weekdays. He more than likely heard us discuss our plans from his cubby in the basement. And that idea still gives me shivers. He'd be content in knowing when he would come and go safely without fear of being caught. That was until Alec arrived home unexpected. I suppose it's no longer important if he was arrested for his crime. All three of us have moved past the experience for the most part. Any long-term effects have dulled with time. A small thing does arise, however. I do wonder if our intruder has moved on to another basement. It's a part of the home most of us spend little to no time in. Perhaps you reading this are one of these people. Can you be so sure no one is lurking undetected below you, listening to your every word and move? Maybe you should go check, just to be sure.